Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. You're listening to the Madman Machine Show 136 for middle of November 2008. And coming up on this episode, we'll talk about 30 reasons to dread Great Depression number 2 from Paul B. Farrell. We'll talk about UCLA's colloquium on the financial crisis. We'll talk about why the USA can't go it alone on a gold standard and much more.
Mad Money Machine is brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Helping investors succeed by matching people with portfolios.
And we'll talk about how misery loves company. And the good news is we've got plenty of company. We'll review the Lazy Portfolio Smackdown, in which Harry Brown was down 10% at the end of October. We'll talk about why did everyone get reelected? And the case for bigger government. Paul B. Farrell has an article out at his Market Watch column, 30 Reasons for Great Depression 2 by 2011. New Deal, bailouts, trillions in debt, anti-tax mindset spell disaster. And I'll have a link to this article in the show notes for show 136. He talks about first the dot-com crash, then second the subprime meltdown, then the mega bubble cycles, and then he lists out here 30 leading edge indicators of the coming Great Depression 2. He says every day there is more breaking news, proof Wall Street's greed is already back to business as usual and in denial, grabbing more and more from the new bailouts R Us bonanza of free taxpayer cash and credits. Like two-year-olds at a toy store at Christmas. Anything to boost earnings, profits, and stock prices and keep those bonuses and salaries flowing. Anything to blow a new bubble. He says, scan these 30 leading indicators. Each problem has one or more possible solutions, but lacks unified political support. Time's running out. We're already at the edge. Add up the trillions in debt. Any collective solution will only compound our problems because the collective cumulative debt will overwhelm us, make matters much worse. And I'm not going to read all 30 of these, but as you read through the 30, I get the sense of tension that you feel when you listen to this Jack in the Box music. Here, take another listen to the Jack in the Box music for a second. Don't you get a sense of impending doom when you know that the Jack in the Box is about to pump out and scare you? And that's why I call this the Jack in the Box economy. Reading these 30 leading edge indicators of the coming Great Depression 2, I have the exact same feeling of dread as waiting for the Jack in the Box to pop out. And it's interesting that he says it's like two-year-olds at a toy store in Christmas. These new bailouts are us bonanza. But I'll read leading indicator number 30 to you. He says, at a recent Reuters Global Finance Summit, former Goldman Sachs chairman John Whitehead was interviewed. He was also Ronald Reagan's deputy secretary of state and a former chairman of the New York Fed. He says, America's problems will take years and burn trillions. He sees nothing but large increases in the deficit. Quote, I think it would be worse than the Depression. Before I go to sleep at night, I wonder if tomorrow is the day Moody's and S&P will announce a downgrade of U.S. government bonds. It'll get worse because the public is not prepared to increase taxes. Both parties were for reducing taxes, reducing income to government, and both parties favored a number of new programs, all very costly, and all done by the government. And Reuters concludes, Whitehead is said he is speaking out on this topic because he's concerned no lawmakers are against these new spending programs and none will stand up and call for higher taxes. I just want to get people thinking about this and realize this is a road to disaster, said Whitehead. I've always been a positive person and optimistic, but I don't see a solution here. And survival blog is always good for a gloom and doom story. For example, somebody says they attended the Marshak Colloquium on Mathematics and Behavioral Sciences at UCLA University. The things attended by lots of UCLA economics professors. And the topic was the current worldwide financial and economic crisis. And they said that they saw it was interesting, balanced, reasoned, and academic view of the current bumps in the road with some modest suggestions for improving matters. But wow, it was all very reasoned, and there was even a little bit of mathematical modeling. But these people are very, very concerned. The immense set of interlocking derivative bets made by the big banks is now acknowledged as a complete house of cards, and one that is currently collapsing. The second speaker made suggestions about policy moves that could be taken, quote, if officials somehow miraculously stop the process in mid-collapse, unquote. Whoever wrote this, MDI, says the whole 2 hours was fascinating, but here are a few of the ideas and comments that I came away with. First one, this is the first global crisis of the globalized world. Likely every country will be affected and all at about the same time. Very different from the crisis of 1929 to 1937. Second, the causes were many. Lax regulation, lax credit reviews, securitization of mortgages, insane investment leverage, pressure for continuously increasing financial profits, herd behavior, deregulation, on and on and on. Third, many financial institutions would be immediately bankrupt if they were forced to value assets at current market prices. Instead, everyone has agreed to claim that certain markets are frozen. The regulators wink. Fourth, deleveraging is essential to the survival of these institutions, but most deleveraging actions actually lower all institutions' capital bases. So it's a self-reinforcing positive feedback cycle. Serious deflation is a genuinely possible outcome. For the first time in our lives, money could become more valuable over time rather than less. On the other hand, most Latin American currency crises began as financial crises. Government frantically created money to prevent deflation, and eventually they got hyperinflation. This too could happen here, according to this article. A former vice president of Citicorp was in the audience. He said that the explosion in derivative instruments ran far ahead of infrastructure, that is, markets for trading them, etc., and far ahead of legal frameworks. He said we haven't even seen the beginning of the counterparty problem. An economist from USC was in the audience and said that we will soon have huge, massive unemployment in the United States. What will happen next? What could happen next is unknown. A Swedish economist in attendance said, quote, dispense with the illusion that you understand what is happening. It was a very interesting couple of hours, says MDI. I was fascinated to listen to an episode of the Lou Rockwell podcast this past week entitled The Case for Bigger Government. And I thought, what in the world could they be talking about? And when you got into listening to it, they said that the size of Congress is too small. We should have more people in Congress. And if you go back and listen to Mad Men Machine Show 127, I said exactly the same thing. I said I wondered what the founding fathers would think of the representative to citizen ratio, a 1 to 689,655 that we now have versus the 1 to 60,000 ratio that they had back then. I think the numbers they give on the podcast are a little bit different, about a half of that size in each case. But the point was exactly the same thing. I came up with this first. Go back and listen to show 127, somewhere in the middle, about the Constitutional Minute. Article 1, Sections 1 and 2 of the Constitution talk about the size of Congress. And on this Lou Rockwell podcast, they talk to an expert about how, you know, Congress, the size of Congress used to increase each year according to the population of the United States. And you'd have a representative for a smaller community of people. The number he gives is actually about 30,000 people. And it'd be a situation where you could actually go to the person's house. I mean, you know who they are. Being in Congress is not such a big deal. They don't turn out to be royalty because there's only 435 of them. Instead, there'd be something like 6,000 of them. And a fascinating idea. Boy, it sounds like a really, really good idea. The excuse they gave in the 20s for doing away with the increasing size of Congress is we ran about out of office space. Well, there's a saying that misery loves company. And boy, oh boy, are we miserable. And wouldn't we love a little bit of company? And there is plenty of company around. Yahoo Finance article Friday, November 14th from the Wall Street Journal. Chagrined, even ashamed about your portfolio losses? Take heart. Even managers with some of the best reputations on Wall Street have seen their holdings savaged this year. Entitled, The Year of Wall Street's Fallen Idols. And they talk about some of the big name mutual fund managers. For example, Bill Miller, the famous manager at Legg Mason Value. His fund has fallen by nearly, get this, 60%. And that's not even the worst of it. Miller's more flexible go-anywhere fund, the Legg Mason Opportunity Trust, is down by 2/3 since the start of the year. My goodness gracious. And you know, if your fund is down by 2/3, what's it take to get back to zero? I've put a table out at the MadMoneyMachine.com website. If you look down there, if you're down 65%, then the gain you need to get back to even is 185% gain. Wow. Misery loves company, and I'll have a link to that article. So we had an election a few days back. Let me get this straight now. The approval rating of Congress was something like 9%. People in the United States, we hate the current members of Congress. Yet, what was the re-election percentage? Almost 100%. I don't even know of anybody who didn't get reelected. It's mind-boggling, the ridiculous design we have of our representatives, of our representative system. It's ridiculous. Let's turn to something a little bit lighter and a little bit happier, shall we? I know that there's something we can find happiness in, and that would be something we pull out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. The weather's getting colder, but that's no excuse for not getting outside. Just put on a warm coat and a warm hat and some warm clothes, get a gloves, and take your iPhone, download an application called geocaching to it, pay $9.99 for it, like I did, and hit the little marker there that says, where am I? Get my current location. Up will come a listing of geocaches near where you are. Now, what's a geocache? In case you don't know, it's basically like a little treasure hunt. It's a GPS-based treasure hunt. And this is volunteers all across the globe, enthusiasts. They go out in the woods or someplace and bury little treasures, usually in little capsules, and they mark the GPS coordinates into an online database that you can find at geocaching.com or now with this iPhone application. And your task then is to follow the GPS coordinates, and the iPhone usually gets me to within about 56 feet. So there's this circle of error. Then you have to kind of go by the clues that are provided in that particular treasure hunt. And you hunt around. You might spend 10, 20, 30 minutes hunting around, looking inside of logs and things, opening up various things to see where the treasure is hidden. And once it's found, you write your name in a little logbook inside there. Sometimes you bring something with you, like a little toy, and you trade it with a toy that's in there. My brother-in-law, they have one specifically for baseball cards. You're supposed to take a baseball card to go find the treasure box and swap it with a baseball card that is already in there. This geocaching for the iPhone, though, at $9.99 is a fantastic bargain, because I know there are special purpose geocaching devices that cost upwards of $200. You know, little GPS units and things. But this is, on the iPhone, it's even better because it connects through the internet to the database. It's a wonderful, wonderful application. We've already gone geocaching a few times around our hometown. We have gone to somewhere we haven't found the item, and most recently we have found the three most recent ones that we've looked for. It's a lot of fun. It's, other than paying $9.99, like all the other tools I've given you so far, the thrill of geocaching is free. Also, out at the MadMenMachine.com website, you'll see the end of October results for the Lazy Portfolio Smackdown. And my goodness gracious, what a horrible year it has been. Even the Harry Brown Permanent Portfolio, which has a quarter in gold, is down 10% for the year. And it's the leader of all the professional Lazy Portfolios. Now, we've got this Wiseacre in the game entries, Mudfud. And he's up 41.8% for the year. Well, good for you, Mudfud. I hope you've got some real money invested in that China Bear Fund. Then Tex Williams, 31.5%. Even Cosmos above zero at 1.1%. Everybody else is down below zero. Quasimodo down 12% is the next one down. All the way down to Pool and Bob at a minus 48.6%. Now, what's interesting is that the average year-to-date returns through October of the professional lazy portfolios is negative 28%. Well, what's the average of the individual game entries? Negative 28%. Time now for the Learning Earning segment, brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. This is the point in the show where we learn how to earn our financial freedom. And my goodness gracious, we need to take to heart these seven principles that IFA has posted at their website. Seven principles for investment. Number one, and you got to believe this, capitalism works. Otherwise, you wouldn't be invested in equities. Right. Number two, risk and return have a positive correlation. Risk and return have a positive correlation. They are correlated together. If you take more risk, you should expect more return. If you're trying to get more return, you should expect more risk, on the other hand. Similarly, if you can't take the risk, you shouldn't expect a high return. Number three, free markets match prices to current levels of uncertainty so that buyers can earn a risk-appropriate return. So this risk, this notion of uncertainty, is this notion of risk. All right. And the market itself will adjust the prices of assets to match the risk in the asset. So you can expect to earn a risk-appropriate return for your investment. Again, over the long term. Number four, the greater the risk, this is the point, the longer the time required to obtain the expected return. The greater the risk, the longer the time required to obtain expected return. Number five, here's the fifth IFA investment principle out of seven. Passively invest. Diversify to the maximum. Maintain a small cap and value tilt and keep turnover and costs and taxes to a minimum. Wise words. Number six, risk exposure must be initially matched to the investor's risk capacity, then monitored and maintained through rebalancing. All right, you know all about rebalancing. And number seven, in your taxable accounts, avoid capital gains, you know, realizing capital gains, and do, though, realize losses. In other words, tax harvest in your taxable accounts. IFA can help you with all seven of these principles. Please go to their website, ifa.com. Contact an advisor there to set up an account, even if it's from transitioning out of your 401k plan into a new IRA using those fantastic Dimensional Fund Advisors mutual funds. Learning, earning. Brought to you by Index Funds Advisors. So I'm liking my new MacBook, the 13-inch, the little cheapy MacBook. Well, it's not cheap compared to the things that you can buy at Costco, I guess, but I'm liking it. It feels so solid. You can't even bend the thing with this aluminum casing that it's got. It's so lightweight. It's amazing how I can close the lid. It will go into sleep mode. I can raise the lid. It will wake up and let me back on the internet. My old notebook, a stupid old Dell notebook, I'd close the lid, it wouldn't go to sleep. Or it would do something crazy or drain the battery, and I open it back up and then it wouldn't get on the internet. Complete frustration! The Mac just seems to work. And, hey, plug it into a secondary display. You know, I use the little display connector and I plug my Mac notebook into a larger secondary display. Guess what? The display settings reconfigure automatically, and I can see the material pop up on the display. Oh, try to do that on my Dell computer. But here's something I don't understand. All right. Even on Windows and Mac both, you've got this little taskbar thing at the bottom of the screen by default. You know where the Windows buttons are and all the applications buttons go down there and the clock and everything goes down at the bottom of the screen. But yet, when you're reading a document or you're reading something on the internet, everything is vertical. You want as much vertical space as you can get when you're scrolling down a page on the internet. Why, oh why, does everybody's computer keep that taskbar at the bottom of the screen then? You can move that thing. I move mine over to the left. Both on Windows and on Macintosh, I move that taskbar to the left side of the screen. You've got more vertical scrolling room with your browser. You can extend the browser all the way from the top to the bottom of your monitor's window. And then over at the side, those little icon things, they keep the same size. They don't resize the little buttons when an icon gets minimized, which I think is more convenient and keeps everything nice and out of the way. It's a better use of real estate. Even CNBC, on the HD version of it, they put stuff over to the side of the window. Well, yeah, I guess they put stuff at the bottom of the window too, though. So it kind of ruins my point. Anyway, why don't you move your taskbar to the side? At the beginning of the show, I talked about a lot of things that were kind of depressing. You know, Paul B. Farrell's article in Market Watch about the 30 reasons for the coming Great Depression number 2, and the economists met at UCLA, and they talk about all the bad things that are happening in the economy, the financial crisis. When you hear depressing stories like this, does it make you hungry? I just wonder if there's some sort of psychological, environmental, psychological, evolutionary psychology is the word I'm looking for, an evolutionary psychological reaction that happens when you sense impending doom that you get hungry. You know, you eat to survive coming catastrophes. And as far as surviving starvation goes, there's one place in the United States that's going to be a lot better off than most people in the United States. And it's my hometown. These people in Huntington, West Virginia, are going to outlast everyone else in the coming collapse Because, according to MSNBC, Huntington is fat. Yeah, my sister sent me this article from MSNBC, I guess it is, from their healthcare section. And also my good buddy Brooks sent me an article from Yahoo. It was the same article. Entitled, West Virginia Town Shrugs at Being Fattest City. Huntington characterized as obese, toothless, and poor in recent report. Monday, November 17th, a portly woman plodded ahead of him on the sidewalk. The obese mayor of America's fattest and unhealthiest city explained why health is not a big local issue. It doesn't come up, said David Fellington. I think it's Fenton, isn't it? David Fellington, 5'9" and 233 pounds, as he walked toward City Hall one recent morning. We've got a lot of economic challenges here in Huntington. That's usually the focus. Huntington's economy has withered. Its poverty rate is worse than national average, and vagrants haunt the downtown Riverfront Park. But the city's financial woes are not nearly as bad as its health. Nearly half the adults in Huntington's five-county metropolitan area are obese, an astounding percentage, far ahead, far bigger than the national average in a country with a well-known weight problem. And it leads in other measures, heart disease and diabetes. Well, it's no surprise to me, being from Huntington. Huntington has, I think, more restaurants and fast food places per capita than any place I've ever seen in the world. I mean, you want anything, you don't have to, you don't walk anywhere to eat. Obviously, you drive someplace, even if it's around the block, but there's about 6 or 10 different places to get a hot dog, just a hot dog place, right? But there's a lot of good places. In fact, I think some of the fast food chains, that's the first place they go, is Huntington, West Virginia, and see how well the restaurant does when it opens up. Even chains such as the Steak and Shake. They've got a Steak and Shake. They've got a donut shops. They've got, let me see what they say. The Huntington phone book lists more pizza places, nearly 200, than the entire state of West Virginia has gyms and health clubs. 149. they say it hosts an annual hot dog festival every summer. I've never seen so many places that are hot dog oriented. I guess it's a cultural thing. Appalachian, said Mayor Fellington, who grew up in Maryland and moved to Huntington to attend Marshall University and stayed put. The article also says that Huntington is a clear-cut leader in dental problems as well, with nearly half the people aged 65 and older saying they have lost all of their natural teeth. Poor Huntington, West Virginia. I'm going there for Christmas, and I can't wait to go to Steak and Shake. Here's another little appropriate quote that I read out at a survival blog from Terry Pratchett from Small Gods. He says, pets are always a great help in times of stress and in times of starvation, too, of course. So the G20 didn't come out and reenact the gold standard across the globe last weekend, like we'd kind of hoped that they would, although nobody really expected that to happen. But I think I now understand why the USA can't go it alone on a gold standard. Let's imagine that the United States decided, all right, we're going to use gold as our money. The dollar will represent a certain amount of gold. Well, what if no other country did that? All the other countries around the world use fiat currencies. They print up a bunch of their monies. They print up pounds. They print up euros. They print up yuan. They print up renminbi. They print up the real. They just print them up, and they use those to come over and buy up our gold. And then what do we got left? I think that's probably the reason why it wouldn't work to unilaterally do that. To back our currency by gold is the other countries would just print up their little counterfeit currencies and buy it all up. So you have to have a worldwide cartel of central banks all printing fiat money, all inflating at the same time, which I guess is one of the reasons why we might as well have a world currency and just inflate the whole thing. And whoever controls that world currency then, the central bank and the people that run it and the people that own it, they're the ones that get rich beyond imagination and end up owning the whole world. All right, I hesitate to tell you about this next one because, you know, the saying, if it sounds too good to be true, well, it probably is. And I know I'm going to be pointed out to be a fool when I tell you about this next thing, because I have participated in it, and it sounded like a really good deal, and I still think it sounds like a good deal, but I wonder if you're going to point out to me the flaw, the thing that I missed about this deal. And here's what it is. It's Microsoft's cashback program for eBay purchases. All right. So I got on eBay. I guess I read an article about gold and how there's this coming short squeeze in gold, the COMEX futures, there people are going to take delivery in December and the gold prices are going to shoot up and this sort of thing. Which got me to thinking, hey, I'd like a gold coin. Got on eBay, I looked up American Eagle, and one of the listings that came up there says gold coin, 900 and, you know, you get them between $900 and $940 for a 1 ounce gold coin. But you get $200 cash back from Microsoft Live if you follow these certain procedures. And here's what you got to do. Go on eBay and find one of these items that claims it participates in Microsoft's cash back thing. Then copy the item number of that auction listing. Now, in your browser, go to live.com. That's Microsoft's search engine. And type in a phrase that might find what you're looking for. For example, type 1 ounce eagle coin or gold coin or gold eagle or something like that. And the search results will come up, and one of the listings there will be for eBay, and it'll have the Microsoft Cashback logo next to it. Very important that you search for the right thing so that it comes back with eBay as an option, and it has the Microsoft Cashback logo next to it. Now, click on that search result. Click on that link that takes you from Live back to eBay. Now you're in eBay. And you see at the top this logo for the Microsoft cashback thing. Now, paste in the item number of the item that you're really looking at, and then do a search in eBay. That'll take you now to that items page. And it has to be a buy it now. Did I mention that? I didn't mention that yet. It has to be a buy it now item. You click on the buy it now button and confirm there in the results that you'll get some Microsoft cash back. Now, if you buy a gold coin for more than $900, the cashback program is something like it's 25% of your purchase you get back from Microsoft. So you get $200, supposedly. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Supposedly you get $200 back from purchasing this gold coin. So now you've bought an ounce of gold for something like $700 or $740, somewhere between $700 and $740. And for an ounce of gold coin, it just sounds too good to be true. But anyway, what happens then? You have to have an eBay account in good standing. You have to have a PayPal account in good standing. And you have to at least sign up for a Microsoft Live account so that the PayPal account and the Live account can talk to each other. And when you buy something from eBay then, that Live account, that Microsoft Cashback program, will get credited with 25% of your purchase price on a qualifying item there. So now one of the caveats is that it takes 60 days for your PayPal account to be credited with the money. So I won't see this money, if ever, until January the 14th or something like that. And I'll try to make a note and let you know if I actually get the money at that time. It just sounds too good to be true. It just sounds too good to be true. Now there's a yearly limit, they say. Microsoft has in their rules a yearly, an annual limit of $2,500 cash back. And so you'd have to purchase $10,000 worth of stuff, I guess, at least, to get that 25% of that or the $2,500 cash back. Let me know if you know what the flaw is in this scheme. I want to thank you so much for downloading this show to your iPod, to your Zune, or your portable MP3 player, or just listening to it in iTunes. This is Paul Douglas Boyer, saying if it takes money to make money, and it takes to make a mad money machine. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, please visit Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com, helping investors succeed by matching people like you with portfolios. Take their risk capacity survey. It's free, and it will help you invest the right way. I appreciate your feedback. There are several ways to get feedback to me. You can email me, feedback@madmoneymachine.com. You can call the voicemail line, 267-344-4763, or use the new anonymous drop.io/madmoneymachine. Drop.io, which I'm told is somewhere out near Indonesia. One of the readers emailed me with that information. Thank you very much. /madmoneymachine. You can post anonymously, although you can also add your name into the posting if you so desire, and I'd appreciate that if you do. And you can read other people's postings, more importantly. So it's like a gigantic community of people who are talking about things related to the Mad Money Machine. And see me at Twitter, twitter.com/madmoneymachine. Until next time, I'm Paul Douglas Boyer. Stay invested in these risky markets.